I'm Karen Garrison, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And it's through the grace of God and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and a step Nazi for a sponsor that I have been sober since May 30th, 1982, and for that I'm very, very grateful. Before I forget, I want to thank Frank and the committee for inviting me to share my life here with you tonight. This is an honor and a privilege, and it's one that I do not take lightly, I can assure you. I love Alcoholics Anonymous more than anything in the whole world, and you're going to soon see why. This program has, there's just no doubt in my mind tonight as I stand here, has saved my life and has started a brand new life for me, and I love it more than anything in the whole world, including my family. Maybe that's not right, but that's the way I feel. I want to thank Bruce and Ellen for picking me up at the airport, and they drove me around Houston yesterday and showed me your colorful city and stuff, and I can't even believe it. I was raised in Texas, you guys, and in San Antonio, and I haven't been back here for many, many years, but, you know, Texas has not changed that much, in my opinion. If you're new in this room tonight, I want to welcome you to God's Magnificent Alcoholics Anonymous, the program that saved my life, and will save yours if you're willing to take some real quick actions and keep it simple, and it took me a long time to get it down to being simple, I'll tell you. I did a couple of things today that I think are the most important things that I can do before I speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and one is to talk to my sponsor, and he told me, he said, you give those people my love and my very best wishes, or I'm going to kick you in the ass when you get off the plane. And so Clancy does send you his love and very best wishes from California. I have the meanest sponsor in the whole world, and I'm not kidding. And I knew you'd do that. I love it. I don't think the day is ever going to come for me, and I get to do this a lot, you guys, and it never fails to amaze me how scared I still continue to get. And I always tell my sponsor, I call him the day whenever I give a talk of the day of it, and I say, Clancy, you know how scared I get? And he says, Karen, I get so goddamn tired of you telling me that you get scared. He said, you get up there and you share your experience, your strength, your hope, you tell those people what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. And he said, ignore the old timers, they're going to get this program sooner or later without your inspiration, my dear. And talk directly to those newcomers who are the life and blood of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that as I stand up here tonight. So I don't see any old-timers in here at all, you know. The hell I don't. Yeah. But anyway, like I said, I absolutely love this program. Clancy also told me another thing to Dan Sloan. He said, stay away from those cowboys. They're not ready for you yet. I don't know if that's true or not. I come from an alcoholic home, you guys, and I come from an alcoholic hell that I can't even describe. It was so bad. The day I got sober, I weighed 95 pounds. I was the color of squash. I had an alcoholic hepatitis. I had ruptured esophageal varices in my throat. And I was dying from alcoholism. I had lost everything in the whole world that I ever wanted to have. Everything was gone. And it finally dawned on me that day. Maybe I'm an alcoholic as I was standing on Skid Row. And it was not a pleasant experience. I can tell you, I hope to God I never have to go through that again. My dad died from alcoholism on the streets of Chicago and Skid Row in 1979. I never dealt with the pain of that until I got sober. And Jesus, it was painful as hell. He never found this program that I know of. If he did find it, he certainly never stayed sober and died as a result of his disease. And I can remember when I was growing up, I used to find pints of Old Crow in my dad's pockets. And I used to think, what is wrong with my father? Why does he hide his alcohol? And I became very, very sick as a result of that, even when I was a child. And alcohol scared me when I was a little kid. It sure as hell didn't scare me as I grew up, you know, and started drinking it. But anyway, I love my dad very, very much. And I basically come from a lovely, lovely home. And I want everybody in this room to know that. I do not do well with people that stand at AA podiums and blame their mom and dad for their alcoholism, because nobody poured it down me, I can assure you. My dad was in the Air Force, and we were stationed at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. And I grew up in that town, and I love that great big city. And due to my dad's alcoholism, he eventually had to take an early retirement and get out of the Air Force. And we found ourselves going back to Lincoln, Nebraska. And I can guarantee you I did not want to go back to Lincoln, Nebraska. And I love that great big city. I love my friends there, and I resented the hell out of that, if you want to know the truth. And I punished my mom and dad for that and did many, many things that I'm very, very ashamed of. But anyway, I have a mother that, you guys, this woman's an absolute trip. This lady's 72 years old. She lives in Lincoln, Nebraska, and she is a corker, let me tell you. My mother does not really believe that I'm an alcoholic. She thinks that I was just having a few problems, and I think a few problems, you know. I sure as hell was. They weren't little ones, though. And I talk to my mom every single week from California, and I talked to Mom Wednesday afternoon, and I said, Mom, I'm going to go down to Texas this weekend. And she says, for what? And I said, I'm going to go down there and speak at an AA retreat. And she says, well, where is this place? And I said, right outside of Houston. She said, oh, my God, don't get up there and tell them all that stuff. She said, they're not going to like you. You know. And, I just about every week when I talk to my mom, I'm going to speak somewhere, and she says the same thing. I love to hear it. That's why I tell her. And she says, you know, people don't want to hear that stuff, Karen. And I said, Mom, the rottener you are in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more they love you. And she says, well, I don't understand that. And I said, well, you don't have to understand it. And she says, for God's sakes, you know, don't tell them that you're afraid, because people don't like people that are afraid. And I said, Mom, the more afraid you are, the more they love you in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, well, I don't understand it. And I said, well, you don't have to understand it. And she's something else, I'm telling you. And then I have a sister who was a model for Neiman Marcus for many, many years in Dallas, Texas. And this woman is absolutely beautiful, you guys. She looks nothing like me, I can assure you. And she retired at the age of 40 years old from modeling, and that's old to be a model. And now she's teaching school in the West Indies. And when I was growing up, I hated this woman. I was jealous of her. She was Miss Rah-Rah in high school and homecoming queen and cheerleader and all that kind of crap. And I used to think, oh, who the hell cares, you know. And today I recognize that as a bunch of crap. I wanted to be just like her, and I could not be. That woman never cracked a book, and she made straight A's, and I never cracked a book, and I made straight F's, and that was the difference. I did not have the tools to do what she was doing. Anyway, as a direct result of this program, I love my sister very, very much. I have a brother who's a pilot in the Navy in Spain, who's a magnificent individual. He's not an alcoholic either. I have another sister who's married to the public defender in Lincoln, Nebraska, who got me out of one hell of a bunch of trouble when I got sober, I can assure you. And I'm welcome in their homes today, and that is a gift from this program. I have two boys that are 25 and 26 years old, and I know I don't look old enough to have kids that age, but I sure as hell am. And this is where it really gets in. Oh, I want to tell you guys, I talk real fast, and you have to... My sponsor always tells me, he says, just will you goddamn slow down? And I always say, Clancy, you talk fast if you'd led the kind of life I'd led, you know? And he said, just slow down. You're not funny, Karen. But anyway, this is where it really starts getting interesting to me. These kids are just unbelievable. I used to blame them for my drinking, and I can't do that anymore, but sometimes I still wonder, if you want to know the truth. I have one that's an alcoholic, you guys, and this guy's 26 years old, and he resides in Lincoln, Nebraska, and he just got picked up for his sixth drunk driving charge, and one more time he's gotten out of it, you know. And I learned a long time ago in this program that it is none of my business. You know, it's God's business, and maybe that kid will get sober, and maybe he won't. But that child tells me today that he loves me, and he used to tell me that he hated my guts, and he meant it. I have another son who's 25 years old, and this is where it really gets interesting. This kid called me a year ago last October from a Nebraskan in Los Angeles, and he said, Mom, I'm getting married tomorrow. And I said, well, to whom? It was a surprise to me that anybody would even have this kid. And he said, well, I'm getting married to Lori. And I said, well, you know, Jeff, you tell me a day before you're getting married. And he said, well, we just planned it. And I said, well, I doubt if I get a plane out of here. The Pope's here, and the accommodations were terrible. And I was right. I could not get a plane out of Los Angeles, and I was really upset about it. And he said, Mom, it's no big deal. It's just going to be a tiny little wedding. Don't worry about it. We'll send you the pictures. Well, you know, you don't tell people like me that. But anyway, I talked to Clancy about it, and he said, well, what the hell are you going to do, Karen, walk? He said, for Christ's sakes, if you can't go, you can't go. Just forget about it, you know. And so I was talking to my mother the next day, and she said, I said, how was the wedding, Mom? And she said, who was that little girl with them? And I said, what little girl? And she said, apparently Jeff's got a daughter that you know nothing about, and I suggest that you call him and find out what's going on. And I called Nebraska, and I said, who is the little girl with you? And he said, Mom, that's my daughter. And I said, why didn't you tell me? You know, I was so mad. I could not see straight. And he said, I was afraid you'd get drunk, Mom. I was afraid you'd get drunk. And I would not have gotten drunk over that. I would have just livid with rage, because I never get to see the little girl grow up. I never get to saw baby pictures or anything, you know. And I was on the next thing smoking back to Lincoln, Nebraska to meet my granddaughter. And let me tell you about this little girl. I got off the airplane and she says, are you my grandma? And I said, yeah. And she says, did you bring me some presents? You know? And for some reason, it dawned on me, this all sounds vaguely familiar, you know? And I said, what is your name? And she says, my name is Brandy. And I thought, that just figures, doesn't it? Anyway, that little girl is the icing on the cake to me, you guys. She's the icing on the cake. I flew her out to Los Angeles last May to give me a cake for my 6th AA birthday, and we have a family night in the Pacific group, and it's a real fun thing. And I got her off the plane, and she talks incessantly. She never shuts her mouth. And I told her, I said, Brandy, do you ever be quiet? And she says, Grandma, I have a lot to say. And I said, well, you know, for Christ's sake, you're giving me a headache. And she said, well, then take some aspirin. Anyway, my son had his second child January the 4th, and I was home for that occasion. And I stood at that nursery window with tears of joy running down my face, because you and I both know that I should not be there. I should not be there. And my son told me, he said, Mom, he was always looking at my little baby grandson, a beautiful baby, and he says, Mom, why are you making such a big deal out of this? And I said, Jeff, you don't understand. You just don't understand. But anyway, I now have two grandchildren, and I'm just real happy with that. I really am. You guys, when I was growing up, I was a first-class asshole. There's just no other way to put it. And I caused my mom and dad all kinds of problems. I was very disruptive when I was growing up, and I was always getting kicked out of classrooms and all that kind of stuff, and they were always at schools trying to get me back in. And my mom used to tell me, why can't you act like the rest of this family, Karen? And I said, you know, well, hell, I didn't know. I didn't know. All I know is that I never felt like I fit in any place, any given time. I didn't study. I hated to study. I didn't know how to study, and I wasn't willing to learn, you know. And all I did was sit and stare at the boys in the classrooms and stare at the men teachers and fall in love with the men teachers. And the men have been the downfall of my very existence, I can assure you. But anyway, I was nothing but a problem as I was growing up, and I was a real heavy child. When I was only about in sixth grade, I weighed about 190 pounds, you know, and I used to eat my problems away. I'll never forget this as long as I lived. When I started noticing boys, I started losing weight. But there was this little boys in my neighborhood when I was growing up, and they used to say, rub-a-dub-dub, three women in a tub, whoops, it's only Karen, you know. One day I grabbed one of these guys and I just literally beat the hell out of him. He never said that to me again. But when I started noticing boys, I started losing weight and started doing a little bit better in that area. And you guys, I'm one of these female alcoholics, and I know of no better way to say it than to say this, that when you pat me on the head, my pants fall off, you know. And it caused me a lot of problems when I was growing up. I really don't remember my first drink. I really don't, but I remember my last one, and that's what's important. When I was growing up, there wasn't a lot of drugs on the streets, and you guys, I know that I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, and I honor that. I identify myself as an alcoholic from this podium, but I'm also a drug addict too, and I need to throw that in as I speak here tonight. In Texas, there was a lot of drugs on the streets, but when we moved back to Nebraska, there wasn't too many. But there was still marijuana, and there was speed and stuff like that. And that stuff used to scare me, but I did it anyway, you know. And when I was growing up, if you got caught in possession of marijuana, you went to prison. You know, today you get a ticket, big deal, you know. But I still did that stuff, and I still loved every bit of it. And my first drink, I remember that as I drank this drink and it went down, that a warm feeling came over me, and my perceptions of reality did indeed change, you know. And the more I drank, the more they changed, and the more I loved it. And like I said, I wasn't studying. I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do. I got pregnant in high school, and I had to get married. And here we were. If this wasn't a case of the blind leading the blind, this guy was 17 years old, and I was 16 years old. I could not cook. I couldn't clean. I couldn't take care of a baby, nor did I wish to, if you want to know the truth. And I can tell you that it was not a pleasant situation. Neither one of us knew how to work, be responsible, or do anything. And this guy, as it must be, I married an alcoholic, and this guy used to come home and beat the living bejesus out of me all the time. And I never, ever saw a man hit a woman before in my life, and I could not believe it. My dad never touched my mother, and I can guarantee you that if he had, he would have gotten cold-cocked. You know, I don't know what, my mother is nobody to mess around with. And in spite of my dad's alcoholism, he never got into a situation like that. And this guy used to beat me up all the time, and I couldn't figure out why, and I used to blame myself for whatever the hell was going on in that household. And I had to get a job and to start to be responsible. And before I knew it, I had two little boys, and I quick found out what caused that and put a halt to it, I can guarantee you. And that caused me a lot of problems also. But anyway, I started working as a nurse's aide at Lincoln General Hospital in Lincoln, Nebraska. And for the first time in my life, I fell into something that I respected and admired, and that was the medical profession and nursing. And I made a plan to myself. I really, really love taking care of these patients, and I would like to become a nurse. And I started thinking about that stuff, and I really respected and admired those people that I worked with, and they taught me how to be a good nurse's aide. And I thought to myself, I'm going to go to nurse's training, and I'm going to divorce this bastard, and I'm getting out of this marriage. You know, and that was my plan, and that's exactly what I did. But first of all, I had to finish junior high. You know. You know, they say that alcoholics don't have willpower, and I'm here to tell you that that is a bald-faced lie. You know, I don't have any willpower as far as my disease goes, but when I want to do well, I can do well. And I worked full-time for 3 years, and I went to school full-time for 3 years. And I basically raised two little boys by myself. And I can guarantee you that I got very little help from that ex-husband. And I became a registered nurse at the age of 27 years old. And if you guys think that I'm proud to stand up here tonight and tell you that I lost my nursing license due to my disease, you're crazy in hell of it. I used to steal drugs from patients and do all that stuff. You know, I had those things back today, but it took me a long time to get them back. I could not believe it when I started doing that stuff. This disease will take you right straight to hell, you know, and I found that out. But anyway, I divorced this man, and a whole new world opened up to me, you guys. I did some drinking in that marriage. I was married to him for 11 years. But basically, I guess it was just social drinking. We did not have the money to do it, and I was busy doing these other things. And so he drank, and I pretty much was sober all the time. But anyway, a whole new world opened up to me when I was 27, and it's called Men and Alcohol. And let me tell you, I went absolutely crazy, you guys. I absolutely loved what I was doing. I've been engaged 8 times, and I never did marry any of those people. 2 of them died from this disease. And one at the age of 34 and one at the age of 42. And I knew, you know, just how real this thing was before I ever got sober, but it wasn't for me. I'm not the one that was, you know, the alcoholic. And, I mean, you know, I got myself into a lot of trouble during that 6 years that I was divorced from this guy. And I want to give you a couple quick stories about what I used to do when I was drunk. And I don't think they're that important tonight, but it's part of my story. I need to tell you where I'm coming from. We have a little town in Nebraska, and it's called Palmyra, Nebraska. And it's a town of about 200 people. And I can tell you that from personal experience, they take a dim view of naked women walking on their highways. And I drank and ran around with the same people for 15, 20 years, and they were nurses that I worked with, and I loved these people. I loved the colorful people, and they were intense people, and they liked to party, and they played hard, and they worked hard. And we've been to the horse races in Omaha, in Clarbon in Omaha, and I had met these two guys from Council Bluffs, Iowa. And like I said earlier, if you pat me on the head, there's nothing I won't do. And the girls told me, they said, Karen, it's time to go home. The horse races have been over with for 3 hours. And I said, well, you run along. I used to think everybody, they were just party poopers. They couldn't keep up with me. And I said, well, just go home. I don't care. I'm going with these guys. And we went to this party, and I really can't tell you much about that party. All I remember is waking up out of a complete blackout on this highway, walking down the highway, carrying my purse and my high heels stark naked. That's what I remember. And the first person I ran into was a state pig, of all the luck. And in Nebraska, I don't know if this is true anymore or not, but in Nebraska, the cops travel by themselves. They don't have a partner. They do in Los Angeles for many, many reasons, but there they didn't at that time. And this guy turned on his light, and I remember thinking to myself, oh, Jesus Christ, what am I going to do? I mean, what can you say when you're stark naked? And obviously, you've been, you know, whatever's been going on. And this guy stopped his car and turned on his light, and he looked at me, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. He said to me, what in the hell are you doing? And I thought, well, that's about the stupidest question I've ever faced in my life. And it was February in Nebraska, and I can guarantee you it's a tad bit nippy in February in Nebraska. And I know now why ducks' feathers freeze, I can assure you. And this guy told me, he says, you get in this car, lady, and don't you touch me. Don't you lay one finger on me. And I told this man, you know, just to show you how sick I am, I didn't even recognize the trouble I was in. All I said was, I'm not getting in that car. You might try and rape me. And he said, lady, I wouldn't bet any money on it. You're disgusting is what you are. And that made me madder than anything that was going on. And I went downtown that night, I think, booked with 13 different charges, assault and battery, kicking in his windshield, verbally abusing this guy, unable to take care of myself, being drunk in public, and on and on and on. And that cost me about $3,000 to get out of that. And I'll never forget what it felt like in that courtroom the very next morning. When I woke up out of in jail clothes, they had to give me clothes to wear, and my brother-in-law, the public defender in Lincoln, Nebraska, was standing there, and he said, Karen, are you crazy or what? What in the hell is the matter with you? And I remember clearly what I told him at that time, and I was to say this many, many times to my brother-in-law, I'll drink if I want to drink. Dennis, this could happen to anybody. He said, I don't think so. But anyway, that's the kind of stuff that I did. And I'll never forget the night I woke up in the emergency room of the hospital that I worked at in the operating room. And I worked in that operating room. I had the same job for 19 years, you guys. And I love that job. I love my profession. And I don't think I can say that enough tonight. I did not mean to do the things that happened to me. And I woke up in that emergency room. And one more time, I'd been at the horse races. I don't do well at the horse races. And I smarted off to some guy, and he had popped the hell out of me. And I had 18 stitches in my mouth. And I'll never forget what this plastic surgeon told me. I worked with this guy for years in surgery. And he says, Karen, we love you so much. What is wrong with you? You need some help so desperately. So let's send you to treatment or something. And I said, just fix my lip and get the hell out of my face. You know, I'll drink if I want to drink. You guys, I was to see my brother-in-law many, many times during my drinking career in that courtroom for bad checks, for drunk driving charges, on and on and on it went for me. I don't think I can think of a thing that alcoholics do that I did not do in my drinking career. As this stuff was going on for me, my kids, little by little, were starting to just stay away from me. They couldn't stand to be around me anymore, and I was starting to get into a little bit of trouble at work. And, you know, when I say a little bit of trouble, that's just what I mean. I had an enabling system set up for myself at that hospital that was absolutely incredible, and I worked hard at it, let me tell you. I'm a good nurse, and I do a good job, and the surgeons liked me, and I loved what I was doing, and therefore you get away with a lot of stuff. And I was starting to oversleep in the mornings. Every night I was drunk, and I was starting to miss a lot of work, calling in sick, and so on and so forth. And the day came for me when they said to me, Karen, you have got to start showing up here on time. We can't be calling you every morning. Now, you know, knock this stuff off, you know. And as it must, I pulled the boner of the century. One Sunday I was on call, and I knew I had a corneal transplant in the morning to be over there for. And I thought I'd better stay home tonight because I have to get up early in the morning, and I don't want to get drunk and get in trouble. And that night at 9 o'clock, it occurred to me, I can go out and have a beer. I can go out and have one beer. I'm bored. I have nothing to do. And that's what I did. And, you know, we don't do that. We don't have one drink, you know. And I woke up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon the next day, 6 hours late for that case, in bed with some guy I'd never seen before in my life. And I can guarantee you that I was scared, and it was not funny anymore. And I called the hospital, and they said, Karen, where in the hell have you been? We've been looking all over for you. And I said, well, I was at home, and the phone was off the hook. Don't make a big deal out of this. And they said, no, you weren't at home. We were over there, and we talked to the kids, and they hadn't even seen you for the whole day. You know, quit telling your bullshit. You know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says clearly, and I'll never forget when I read this, it said that eventually we back ourselves into a corner that we can no longer lie, steal, or cheat our way out of anymore. And I was beginning to get in that corner with my drinking. And they said, you be in the director of nurses' office Monday morning, you are in trouble. And I showed up at that conference, and the director of nursing told me, she said, Karen, you're either going to treatment or you are fired. That's all there is to it. And, you know, you guys, you don't tell me that. You don't tell me that. And I said, you and what army's going to make me? And I walked out of a job that I loved more than anything in the whole entire world. I loved that job more than I loved my own family. And I'm not saying that's right. That's just where I was. And I went out of there, and I drank over that, and I drank, and I drank, and I died a little bit at a time. And I went and I got two more nursing positions, one at a nursing home in Lincoln, Nebraska. And you guys, please don't get me wrong in here tonight. I'm not knocking nursing homes. But I got that position, and I thought to myself, you know, last year I was working in the operating room, and I had a magnificent position, and now I'm working in a nursing home cleaning up crap, and I did not like it much, I can tell you. And I couldn't even keep that job. I was just becoming unemployable as time was going on. And I found myself stealing drugs at that nursing home and taking stuff from little old people that could not even defend themselves. And like I said, if you think I'm proud of that, you're crazier than hell. And I found myself getting into Demerol, getting into morphine, and doing what I had to do. At this particular time in my life, I had 8 prescriptions for Valium, and I got those from Lincoln surgeons, and I lied to get every single one of them. I told them that I had a little anxiety going on, when in fact I was having severe tremors in the morning, and I needed to do something to stop those tremors so I could go to work. And that went on for me for many, many years. And those prescriptions finally ran out. And about this time in my life, I thought, you know, I've got to get married to my children's father again. That's what I need to do. This guy needs somebody to get even with him with all the things that he did to me, and the kids really need him, and I'll try and make it work, but I'll get even with him in the meanwhile. And this guy was still in love with me, and it was easy to get him back, and we got married again. And I can tell you guys from personal experience that if anybody in this room is thinking about getting married again, don't do it to the same person. You're going to be sorry. And what it reminds me of is it's like taking a bite out of the same turd twice, if you will. You know. And I can guarantee you, I can guarantee that I danced that guy through three of the most miserable years of his life. And he finally fled the state and moved to Sacramento, and he was glad to get away from me. But I got to tell you guys a story about what I did to this guy during that second marriage. And this story is I can't even believe today that I did this, but I'm perfectly capable of doing it again, I can assure you. Sometimes I think about myself and I think, who was that person? Who the hell was that? But now and then something will pop up if the right buttons are pushed that I know that old Karen's alive and well, let me tell you. This guy came home one night in our second marriage and I was sober that night for some unknown reason, and he came home drunk. And girls, you know what guys do when they come home drunk. They want to take you to bed, and I wasn't buying it that night, believe me. I don't want anybody bothering me when I'm sober and they're drunk. They make me sick and just stay the hell away from me. And I would think that he would have learned that over the years, but he never did. And he took that as a personal insult, if you will, and he broke my arm. And I'm telling you, I was pissed. As a matter of fact, I'm still pissed about it, if you want to know the truth. And I remember telling this guy, you go to sleep, Denny, and you're dead, let me tell you. And he believed me, he really did. And he sat up on the couch for hours with his, keeping his eyes open like this, And I was sitting there, and I started drinking martinis. And martinis tell me, you guys, alcohol runs me. I don't run it. And alcohol started telling me to do stuff to this guy that was absolutely incredible. And as it must, he finally passed out on the couch, and he was laying there, and what he was doing, and I know of no other way to say this than one more time just to say it. He was laying on the couch playing with himself. And I was sitting there watching him, and I thought, you disgusting bastard. You make me sick. And I thought to myself, what can I do to get even with this guy that he'll never hit me again as long as he lives? And my kids had just gotten some super glue. The idea... you guys, I'm a nurse and I'm very familiar with male anatomy. And I can assure you that I'd be familiar with male anatomy if I wasn't a nurse, And I knew just what to do. And I read the directions and I had about 8 martinis and it always sounded real funny and real good. And I poured super glue all over this guy's groin, and I mean everywhere, Denny didn't have the fortune of being circumcised when he was born, and now he wishes he had been, believe me. And anyway, I had no intentions of hurting this guy as bad as I did. I don't know what the hell I wanted, for it to tug a little or something. I don't know. And anyway, I read the directions, and I apparently misread the directions. I thought what they said was, if this hits human skin, get it off within 15 hours. And now why the hell would it say that, And come to find out, what it said was, if this gets on human skin, get it off within 5 minutes. And this is when super glue first came out, you guys, about 15 years ago, and it was powerful stuff, and you didn't want to screw around with super glue. And I laughed about it, and I went to bed. And if there was one thing that this guy always did, he always got up and went to work. He never missed going to work. And it was about 3 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up in the morning to screams of horror like you can't even believe. And what had happened was the foreskin ripped. You know what guys do when they get in the morning? They have to pee, right? And he had an erection and it ripped, And he was in trouble, let me tell you. And I thought to myself, oh, no. And we had a phone by our bed there in our home in Lincoln, Nebraska. Now, you guys got to keep in mind, they don't see this stuff in Lincoln, Nebraska. They just don't see it. If this happened in L.A., I wouldn't be a bit surprised, but not in Lincoln. Anyway, this guy called the police, and I was arrested for assault and battery in my own home. And these cops, I'll never forget this, they came to the house with an ambulance, and they took him to the hospital that I worked at in surgery. And one more time, they saw what Karen Garrison did, But these cops were laughing, and they said, lady, are you out of your mind? Why the hell would you do something like that? And I said, because I felt like it, that's why. I said, what about my arm? What about my arm? I had not one thought of what I had done to this man, not one thought. To show you how self-centered and sick I was. And they said, you really hurt him bad. And I said, good, And they took me to jail. And now in Nebraska, I don't know about Texas, but in Nebraska, you cannot arrest your wife for assault and battery or for press any charges against a wife or a husband. And I was out of that jail in 10 minutes flat, I can assure you. And this guy had to have surgery at the hospital that I worked at, and he was in the hospital for 2 weeks. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm getting the hell out of this marriage, because when this guy gets home, he is going to kill me, and there's no doubt in my mind that he would have, believe me. And I, one more time, divorced him. And, you know, there's a paper written about that at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska Medical School. It seems my whole life I've caused people nothing but problems, and I can guarantee you they had a terrible time getting that glue off that guy, and they had to get two surgeons down from Omaha that knew what the hell they were doing, and apparently there's a paper written about that now, and I've always wanted a paper written about me, but not like that. And I guarantee you that guy's having problems today, and I know that because he told me. So Clancy made me go to Sacramento and sit down and make amends to this guy, and I did not want to do that. I told Clancy, I said, I'm not sorry I did that. And he said, I don't give a damn whether you are or not. You're going to... He said, how could you... He said, Karen, are you out of your mind? Why would anybody do something like that? And Clancy, we were around two other guys when I was telling him about what I'd done to Denny, and I remember Clancy looking at these two other guys, and he said, shit, we got off easy, guys. We got off easy. But anyway, he made me go sit down and talk to that man, and I can tell you that it really turned out well for me, and it's a real gift of this program, our men's steps, And I walked away from that, free from that man, and free from what I had done, and free from those marriages, and that's a gift from our program, I can assure you. But anyway, that's the kind of stuff I did, and that's the kind of trouble I was starting to get into. And I got another job. I got fired from that nursing home because I got caught stealing medications. And I got a job at Bryan Memorial Hospital in Lincoln, Nebraska. And, you know, the word gets around real quick in Nebraska when you're a crappy nurse, I can assure you. And the word was starting to get around about me. And I told those people at Bryan, I said, you know, I'm from Denver, Colorado, and I just moved here, and I want a nursing position, and I'll be damned if they didn't hire me. And I was drunk on that interview, you guys. I don't mean falling down drunk, but this time I was just trying to maintain a certain level of alcohol in my system where I wouldn't have tremors, you know. But I was loaded. And I kept that job for 3 months doing the same things that I was doing at that nursing home, stealing drugs and doing all that kind of stuff. And the day came for me where I got caught red-handed stealing some morphine. And I will never forget this day as long as I live. They said, you give us your narcotic keys and you get the hell out of here. You know, what is the matter with you? You'll never get a nursing position again as long as you live. We're going to report this to the State Board of Nursing. And that's exactly what they did, and that's what they should have done to the other two jobs, too. And I'll never forget what the State Board of Nursing told me. They said, you're a disgrace to your profession, you're a disgrace to nursing, and you're a disgrace to medicine. And you're not working anymore. We have just taken your nursing license away. And I was so upset, you guys. And I love my profession so very, very much. And I walked out of there, and I died and died and died 100 times over because of that. And eventually, it got progressively worse for me. You know, by this time, my car was gone. It was repossessed. I wasn't paying bills. I never even opened bills up. My kids were long gone. My family was starting to tell me, you get the hell out of our lives, and we don't want to be around you anymore. You are disgusting, Karen. You are not going to do this to us. And I found myself on the streets of Nebraska drinking Mad Dog. And if you guys haven't drank Mad Dog, you don't know what the hell you're missing, I can tell you. That stuff will make you crazier than hell, and I was there already. You guys, I have seen things that no woman should ever see. No woman should ever see. I have prostituted myself. I have done whatever I had to do to get that alcohol and to get that drugs and to keep going, you know. I have traveled all over the United States. I've hitchhiked, and I've been in some pretty precarious situations, I can guarantee you. And the only thing that's ever worked for me is Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been through every therapy I can name off the top of my head. I've been in nut houses. I've been strapped down. I've been in jail. And I've been through all that stuff. And I can guarantee you that it was not fun anymore to be doing any of this stuff. You know, in the big book, it talks about how cunning and baffling powerful our disease is. And I can really relate to that because I am a nurse and I have studied alcoholism. And I know what alcoholism is, but I could not stop my own. I could not stop it, which shows me one more time how cunning, baffling, and powerful it is. And if I quit taking the direction and quit taking the action of this program, then I'm going to wind back up there again. And I don't want to do that. By this time, you guys, I was keeping alcohol under my bed. I was drinking right out of the bottle. There was no more mixed drinks for me. You know, I was a beer drinker for years, and when I got into the vodka and the gin, I got into one hell of a lot of trouble, let me tell you, because I drank that stuff like I drank beer, and I loved the way it made me feel. And I was starting to turn funny colors, you know, and my liver was not processing this stuff anymore, and I was getting into a lot of trouble. I was losing a lot of weight. And, you know, in the big book, it talks about how we get caught up in that quicksand and stuff, you know, in that one part. And I'll never forget when I read that in the book. I thought, Jesus, it was so true for me. You know, I literally could not quit drinking. And I tried to. And I would go 2 or 3 hours without drinking. I was drinking around the clock practically just to maintain that level so I wouldn't go into all this withdrawal. And I was scared. I was absolutely terrified. I thought, I am dying from this. I need some help. What the hell am I going to do? I'll get some help tomorrow. You know, all that stuff that we go through. And I never could do any of it. You know, I would just get up and drink and just die again. And as it must, one day on 9th and O Street in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I was back there again in my hometown and standing there, and I don't even really remember much about this day, to tell you the truth, except I remember thinking to myself, I used to drive by this street corner when my kids were little, and my kids would say to me, Mom, who are all those men over there? And I said, well, those are alcoholics. Those are bums on Skid Row, and they don't have jobs, and they don't have cars, and they choose to drink, and that's the way they want to live, you know. And I used to think to myself, I'm not like them. I still have a job. I still have a car, a family. I am not an alcoholic. And that very day that I was so sick and stuff, I remember thinking of it one more time, thinking about that, and thinking to myself, yeah, and I bet these people that I'm standing here drinking with used to think the very same things as they're standing on Skid Row. But anyway, you guys, I don't know what happened for sure. All I know is that I wound up in an intensive care ward at Lincoln General Hospital, the very hospital I was born at, that I worked at for 19 years, had my kids at, and all this stuff. And I found myself in withdrawal that I cannot even begin to tell you the alcoholic hell I was in. That started for me when I got sober, let me tell you. And it was just absolutely horrible. You know, I hope I never have to go through that again. And I remember I used to scream at those nurses, and they were very concerned about my life. And I said, you give me some Librium or some Valium or something and to stop these tremors, and I cannot stand this, you know. And they say, you know, they used to tell me, they'd say, Karen, your heart's not throwing any irregularities. You need to feel every one of these tremors, and maybe you'll never do it again. And, you know, I'm real glad about that today. I wasn't at the time, but I am today, because I think I needed to feel every single one of every bit of that withdrawal, because it stops me cold in my tracks every time I think about drinking today. And, you know, they say that most alcohol withdrawal is over within 3 days, and it was not for me, I can tell you, you guys. When I got sober, I was drinking a quart of gin a day, and I was taking 200 milligrams of Valium a day. And that is a lot of booze, and that is a lot of pills. I'm not very big. And I can tell you, I was sick for a solid 30 days. But let me tell you what those people in that intensive care ward did for me. They got me people in Alcoholics Anonymous to come and sit with me. And they sat with me around the clock, day and night, for one solid month. And I remember looking at these women, and I couldn't figure out what they wanted. I said, why are you here? And they said, we're just here to be with you, Karen. You know, we're all recovering alcoholics. I'd like to help you. And I said, help me. I said, you know, I'm in a terrible, terrible place. I don't have a nursing license. My kids are gone and all these things. And they said, those things had happened to them too. And that they had gotten all those things back through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember thinking to myself, I wonder if this is possible for me. And I asked one of them, and you guys, I remember very little about being in that intensive care ward, but I remember this vividly. And one of them looked at me and she said, we think that anything is possible in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you do what we tell you to do, you too can get sober. And a little flicker, just a tiny little flicker of hope began to happen for me. I will never forget these women as long as I live. And a deep bond was set up with me with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from day one. And at a month of sobriety, I found myself into that formal recovery program. And you guys, I goddamn hated treatment. I hated treatment, you know, and I did not do well there. And I walked into that formal treatment program at 30 Days of Sobriety, and I walked into my first group therapy session, and if anybody in this room has been in group therapy, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I was in treatment with 14 men, and I was the only woman, and it totally griped my ass that I was the only, I'm the only woman, look at all these guys, but they were all younger than I was, you know. That shows you how sick of a person I really was, because I was dying from this disease, and I was trying to find a man, for Christ's sakes, you know. And, you know, a lot of people got kicked out of treatment when I was there for fraternizing, and I can guarantee you that I did not get kicked out of treatment for fraternizing, because nobody wants to fraternize with an orange person, you know. But anyway, I'll never forget this first day in group therapy, because I walked in and this one guy looked at me and he said, you think you're better than everybody else here, don't you? And I remember what I told this guy. I said, yeah, you asshole, and you can put your name at the top of the list, you know. And that's just the way I acted when I was there. And I went through many, many counselors, and I was to pay for that statement for a long, long time there, you know. The patients get each other sooner or later. And I was an inpatient, you guys, for 7 months. An inpatient, and I hated that place. And I think I did 18 first steps while I was there, and I never did do any of them right. And they used to make me turn my chair around in group therapy and look at the wall. Well, that didn't bother me. I was more than happy to do that. I had to look at them, you know. And I know a couple times they said, you know, Karen, we really ought to kick you out of here, but we're afraid you're going to die. And I'm glad that they had that attitude, because I would have died. And I said, well, you know, I'm just going to leave here if you don't quit talking to me the way you talk to me. I don't like this much, and I'm, you know, after all, I'm a professional nurse. And they said, oh, really? Well, you don't even have a nursing license, hot dog, you know. And I'll never forget how bad that made me feel, you know. But it was so very true. And they said, go ahead, Karen, leave. There's two cops out there with warrants, you know. And I decided to stay, let me tell you. And I thought, well, I guess I'm just destined to take crap off people for the rest of my life. And so anyway, I completed that inpatient program. I completed an evening care program. I completed an outpatient program. And I completed aftercare. And this whole process took about 2 years. They tell me from day one that you will become an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous while you are in this treatment center. And I said, well, I won't be doing that because I am a professional nurse. For Christ's sakes, you know. And they said, well, you know, it's either that or you have to leave. And so I did start going to meetings of AA. And a funny thing happened for me. I fell in love with you guys. I absolutely fell in love with you. I can tell you that it was a pleasure for me to sit down and have a glass of iced tea with somebody when I got sober. And I know that sounds very, very childish, but everybody in my life was gone. And you guys, I basically love people. I really do. I love a lot of people around. And I missed my friends, and now I have people back in my life again. And I was somewhat satisfied with what was going on. But a funny thing happened after about 2 or 3 weeks of sobriety. You know, people start telling you what you should be doing in this program, and I don't take kindly to that. And I can tell you that I started getting very resentful towards the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I left that treatment center, I graduated from there, whatever, and I became a very active member in AA in Lincoln, Nebraska. But I can guarantee you that I was doing nothing like you're supposed to do it. I was running around Alcoholics Anonymous like it was rush week, you know. And the day came for me when one of the old, but I was going to meetings and I was staying sober. And one of the old timers grabbed me one day, and I know a lot of you old timers in this room are going to love this story. And this guy literally grabbed me by the neck, and he said, you know, Karen, he said, you're a little bitch is what you are. He says, you don't tell these new people they don't have to read the book and go to meetings and get a sponsor. He said, you keep your goddamn mouth shut, and don't you even go near these new people. Stay the hell away from them, you know. And that made me feel bad. It really did, you know. But that's exactly what I was doing, was telling these people that stuff. You know, I heard early on in Alcoholics Anonymous that you can do your own thing here, and that's exactly what I was for, believe me. You know, and they also told me that to get close to people when I was brand new in A, and I was more than happy to do that with the men, too, I might add. But anyway, this guy also told me, he said, there's going to be a man in Kearney, Nebraska next weekend speaking. He is from California. His name is Clancy. And you're going to go up there and you're going to ask him to sponsor you. You have been through 19 sponsors in this town and we are sick of you. And I said, I'm not going up and hearing anybody speak at any goddamn convention and you're not telling me what I'm going to do. And he just looked at me and he said, Karen, if you don't go to this convention and talk to this man, I'm going to tell everybody in this town how you stole money from a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Believe me, I went to Kearney, Nebraska to hear Clancy talk. I paid it back already, too, by the way. But anyway, I found myself listening to that man, and I can tell you guys that from a podium in Kearney, Nebraska, that man put the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous into my life. I've heard many, many fine speakers in AA, and there was nothing wrong with anything that any of them were singing. I just wasn't ready to hear any of it yet. And, you know, I really believe the old adage, when the pupil is ready, the teacher appears. And apparently I was ready at that time. And I was fascinated by this man and what he was saying. I have never heard anybody that is able to explain alcoholism the way this guy can explain it. And he stood up there and he told me, you know, I was the only person in that room of 2,000 people. I was so damn self-centered. I thought he was just talking to me. And he explained how alcoholism is a disease of the perceptions, and that when you get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, that you get sicker, and that you need to get heavily involved in this program. You need to get a sponsor. You need to talk to that sponsor. You need to start reading the book, working with newcomers, and doing what we do to stay sober in this program. And I sat there and I thought to myself, maybe this would work for me. Maybe I need to get this guy for a sponsor. It was an absolute miracle for me. I don't ask anybody for help. And amazingly enough, after that man's talk was over, I went up to thank him, and I found myself. And he told me, he says, I have heard all about you, Karen. These old-timers that are with you have told me about you, and I'll guarantee you I'm not screwing around with somebody that can't find their ass with both hands, you know. And he was referring to me. And he said, when I tell you to do something, I want you to do it. I want you to call me every single day, though I tell you not to call me every single day. I don't care how much goddamn money it costs you. Get two jobs if you don't like it. And he said, I want you on that phone at 11 o'clock every single morning talking to me. And I want you reading the book. I want you to sponsor people. I want you to get heavily involved in AA. I don't want you to argue with these old-timers in Lincoln, and they're going to tell me if you do. And he said, I want you to be a very active member of AA in Nebraska. And I said two words, and I almost fell over when I said them, you guys. I said, yes, sir. You know, and I say that today, too. I don't mind telling you. I tip my hat to that man. I'm terrified of him most of the time. And I think that's good. I think that's good. I, you know, when I met Clancy, I thought I had finally met my match by a long shot, you know. And he does not put up with my crap for 1 minute, I can assure you. And as a direct result of having him for a sponsor, my life is completely turned around, you know. He's really made me take the actions and really do the stuff, and I've gotten nothing but better on every single direction he's given me. The first direction that my sponsor gave me was something that, you know, I did not want to do at all. And he said, Karen, what do you do for a living? You know, and I said, well, I'm not working. You know, and he said, why not? And I said, I'm just not working. And he said, what did you used to do? And I said, I used to be a nurse. And he said, why aren't you a nurse today? And I sat there and I cried and I cried and I cried, you guys. I did not want to tell anybody this humiliating experience that had happened to me. And he says, the first direction I'm giving you is you go get that nursing license back, and I don't give a damn what you have to do. You go to that State Board of Nursing, and you tell them that you will do anything that they say to do and to go to any length that they want you to go to, and don't you call me or talk to me until you do it. And I sat there trying to explain to Clancy that I was not going to be able to do that, that you know, I was scared, and he said, God damn it, just do what the hell I tell you to do. And I can tell you that that's exactly what I did, and I had to do a lot of stuff, you guys, to get this license back. I had to take crap off people for 3 years that I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn, if you want to know the truth, you know. I look at that today, and that's exactly what should have happened. And one of the happiest days of my life happened about 3 years ago, when one more time I was pulled in from the State Board of Nursing in Nebraska, and what they told me was, welcome home. You're fully reinstated as a registered nurse. And that is a gift from Alcoholics Anonymous, I can assure you. And, you know, my life is just totally different today. He told me to get back to Lincoln and to get busy and start doing this stuff and to get out of debt. And he said, I don't care if you have to get two jobs, Karen. You got $48,000 to pay off, and that's what you're going to do. And I said, but the other people are filing bankruptcy. And he said, I don't care what they're doing. You're paying the bills back. You're the one that accumulated them, and you're paying them back. He's made me make amends. That man has made me do stuff I would never do, you guys, never. But I've done it because he's told me to do it. And my life started to gradually get very, very different. And I started liking my life, let me tell you. And I became a very active member one more time in Nebraska. And I wound up by sponsoring 56 women there, you guys. And I'm not bragging about that. I was just around a lot. We had very poor female leadership in Lincoln, Nebraska. And a lot of people asked me to work with them. And I love those women. And I spent a lot of time with them. And I flew out to California for my sponsor's birthday. And I fell in love with California AA. And I had to be part of it. And I told Clancy, I'm going to move to California. And I have learned the hard way. You don't tell my sponsor what you're going to do. You know, you just might suggest it. And if he goes along with it, it's fine. But don't say, well, I'm going to do this. He said, no, you're not going to come to California until those bills are paid and every single amend is made. That's when you can come to California. And I spent the next 3 years of my life cleaning up the mess I made in Lincoln, Nebraska. And the day came, and he says, okay, you can come to California now. And I went out there, you guys, and I wanted to work at UCLA, and I wanted to live in Venice, California, the colorful Venice where they say the debris hits the sea, you know. And that's just, that's just exactly what it is. I find that I fit in there very nicely. And I wanted to work in the operating room at UCLA. I wanted to be a member of the Pacific Group. I wanted this. I wanted that. And every single one of those things has come true for me as a direct result of this program. And I moved out to California almost 3 years ago in May. And I have absolutely loved every single minute of it. I work full-time at the University of California in L.A. at UCLA. And I work in the operating room. And I'm on two of their transplant teams. And I find myself being flown all over the western part of the United States of America harvesting organs for UCLA. And if you guys don't know what that is, you go out and get the organs and bring them back, and we do transplants. And it's a magnificent job, and it's one that I do not deserve. But I can tell you that it is just a job. It's all it is, and I've been taught that by all of you, that the center core of my very existence had better be God in this program and not some damn job, you know. But it's nice to have this. It's nice to be back in there, and it never fails when I drive in there at night. I work the 11-7 shift, and I drive in, and I think, isn't this just unbelievable? You know, I'm working at magnificent UCLA, and I'm sober. You know, I never would have dreamt those things for myself. I'm very, very active in California. I do a lot of stuff out there. I sponsor a lot of people. I go to AA every day like I drank, and I've been taught to do that, and I'm not comfortable if I don't do that. And having Clancy for a sponsor, there's a lot of things that you're going to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and sometimes I really get so damn tired of all of it, I could just scream, you know. And he said, yeah, well, you quit doing any, but you're going to get drunk. Take my word for it, you know, so I keep on doing it. And, you know, my life as a result of all this has just totally, absolutely changed, you guys. And I want to tell you a couple quick stories, and I'm going to sit down. I want to go over here about a story about how I came to believe in God in this program. And I love to share this. I really do. And, you know, I'm very grateful tonight for the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never thought I would ever say that. And, you know, you guys hold the light for me. You show me how to do it, you know, and I'm so grateful that you kept the door swinging like a, so a jerk like me could, you know, get sober and become a part of this fellowship. And Clancy had told me, he said, where are you with your spiritual program, Karen? And I said, I don't have a spiritual program. I said, I don't believe in God, and I'm not going to believe in God. And he says, you start getting on your knees in the morning and asking for your sobriety, and you get on your knees at night and thank God for your sobriety. And I said, I'm not going to do that. And he said, oh, aren't you? Do it, you know. And so anyway, you know, I just know that your motives don't have to be good to take the actions that eventually good things are going to happen. And I had a chance to go to Montreal, the World Conference, you guys, and I was still living in Nebraska at the time, and I could not afford to go to this thing in Montreal. And I made four people that I sponsored go, and we drove straight through from Lincoln up to, in a car with five alcoholics driving straight through. I mean, we were at each other's necks the whole trip. You can just well imagine. We had no place to stay. We had $200 apiece, and we got up there, but we were going, and we didn't care what happened. And my sponsor was going to be doing that workshop up there, and I wanted to be there for it. And we got up there and we found an apartment to rent for $100 and for the whole week, and we really got off easy. And other people were spending $100, $200 a night for hotels, and we found this apartment, and we were 15 minutes from the conference. And I will never forget as long as I live how it felt to be in that stadium that night in Montreal. And I looked around myself, and there was 52,000 people in that stadium, and they were practicing for a flag ceremony on the football field. And my sponsor was helping them with that flag ceremony. And I ran down and I said, hi, Clancy. And he said, Karen, I want you to meet so-and-so from New Zealand, from France, from wherever. And, you know, I'm from Nebraska, you guys, and I was impressed, let me tell you. And I'm impressed today, you know, when I meet people from all over the world. And I could not believe, you know, what was going on. And I ran back up and to join my friends from Lincoln, and that flag ceremony started. And I will never forget this as long as I live. When the United States of America's flag touched the turf of that stadium, how 52,000 people went absolutely crazy. And I looked around myself, and I could not believe it. I had a real warm feeling in the pit of my gut, and I felt tears in my eyes. And you guys, when I got sober, I would not have cried. If you would have put a knife at my neck, I would not have cried. And for the first time in my life, I did not try and stop these tears. And I remember saying to myself, for the first time in my life, I was talking to God with some sincerity. And I said, God, thank you for getting me here. Please help me to stay here. Please help me to love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as these people do. And I really wanted what you guys have, and I was willing to do anything you wanted me to do to get it, you know. And I remember these old-timers were tears of joy running down their cheeks. And I stood there and I cried. And I, for the first time in my life, I felt like I was a part of something. For the first time in my life, I felt like I really, truly belonged right exactly where I was at that moment. And I made a plan to myself. I will stay in this program and I will do what the hell they tell me to do, and I will not argue with them anymore. And it was a beautiful experience. And, you know, I felt good when I was drinking, you guys. And I love the feelings that I got from drinking. But I can tell you, the feelings I got in that stadium that night far out exceeded any feelings I've ever gotten from alcohol. And so what they say is true, that AA will replace your drinking. And it sure as hell did for me that night. And, you know, I just went home on a high like I couldn't even believe. And I've talked to God sincerely every day since that time. You know, and God's very much a part of my life today. And it's because some old mean sponsor told me to do something that all these things happened. I have one more story to tell you guys, and I'm going to sit down. And it's a story about a transplant that we did at UCLA. And I love to tell this story, and it shows you exactly where I'm at with my sobriety. You know, we have a terrible nursing shortage all over the nation right now, and we're overworked and underpaid, and I'll be the first to bitch about it, I can assure you. And this particular week, I worked 72 hours, and I was exhausted. I really was. And I had the night off, and my boss called me. And my boss's name is Gerlinde, and she's from West Germany. And she makes Clancy look like a pussycat, I can assure you. And this woman is the best nurse I have ever seen in my life. And when I grow up, I want to be just like her someday. And she runs her 86 operating rooms, and nothing hardly ever goes wrong, I can assure you. And the residents are terrified of her. You know, I love to see her jump all over them. But anyway, she called me, and she says, Karen, we're going to do a transplant, a little three-year-old girl, and I need you to come over and help me. I got people sick, and we don't have enough staff, and I want you to come over. And I said, God damn it, I am tired, I'm not on call, and I'm not coming. I need the night off. And she said, I need you, Karen. And, you know, my sponsor, I get so tired of the things he's taught me because they immediately come to my mind in these situations. And I immediately thought to myself, do what's in front of you, Karen, and don't debate it. That's what he's taught me to do. And so I was going to call him, and I thought better of it, and I just went to work. I got over there, and we were going to do a liver transplant, a little three-year-old baby girl, you guys. And this little girl was so sick, you guys. She was so sick and dying from some strange liver thing. And we got there, and they sent the jet back east to get the liver in, and it was still in the air, and we weren't ready to quite get started yet. And we sent for our little girl, and we had about 20 minutes to kill. And my orderly came back, and he said, your patient's out front. And he says, Karen, you're not going to believe all the people with this family. And I said, well, who are they? And he said, I don't know, but he said, there must be 50 people out there with his family. And I went out front to get my little patient. And the first thing that I noticed was, you know, you guys, I was real crabby that night, real crabby and irritable, and you know how we are, you know. And I went out, and something changed me. I saw this family, and I looked, the first thing I noticed was the mother, and this gorgeous woman, and she had the prettiest blue eyes I've ever seen in my life, and her husband was good-looking. And I looked down at my little patient, and I looked into those same beautiful blue eyes that mother had. And this little girl was so sick, you guys. She was just dying is what she was doing. And she looked up at me, and I'll never forget this, and immediately my attitude started to change, and I thought, God, please help me take good care of this little baby girl, you know. And the mother and father were just in hysterics and stuff, and we sent them out to the waiting room. And I told that little girl, I said, say, that's a cute little bear that you have there. And she was holding on to a little bear, and she said, that's my nurse bear. And I said, well, what's your bear's name? And she says, it's a nurse bear. And you know, it's not a man, it's just a nurse bear. And I said, well, what's its name? And she says, well, what's your name? And I said, my name is Karen. And she said, well, that's my bear's name. And you guys, this little kid was so sick, she could hardly lift her head off the pillow. And she looked at me, and she said, why is my mommy crying? Why is my mommy crying? And I said, because your mom loves you so much, you know. And she had no idea how sick she was, you know, and mom and dad fully expected to never see their child alive again. And I can tell you, we took that little girl back to surgery, and that case did not go well, you guys. It did not go well. We almost lost that kid a couple times on the table. But I have never seen such a team effort before in my life. I have never seen people work together like they worked on that little kid that night. And she survived that 16-hour liver transplant, and she went back to her room. And I became obsessed with this child. And we have a rule at UCLA is that you do not get involved with these transplant patients because they want to know where the organs came from. We cannot tell them, and it's best not to see them after surgery. And, you know, I'm real good at breaking rules, you guys, real good at that. And I thought about it incessantly, and I thought, I don't care what they say. I'm just going to go up and see her, and I'll just open her door, and I just wanted to see how she was doing, and I won't talk to anybody. And I went upstairs, and I opened that little girl's door, and you guys, I could not believe what was in front of my face. My God, the power of God, the power of God. Here was this little baby girl, and she was 6 days post-op from that liver transplant, and she was jumping up and down in her crib, and she had that little bear in one arm, and she had a baby bottle in the other, sucking on that baby bottle, and that's okay, you know. And she was jumping up and down, and the diapers were hanging around her knees, and she had her dressing on her belly, and this little bear had Band-Aids all over it and stuff. And her mom had French braided her hair, and she had ribbons in her hair, and she was screaming, help. And it was apparently the first time she'd been up since her surgery. And her mom and dad were sitting there with tears of joy running down their faces. And I thought, isn't this just unbelievable? And anyway, the mother looked at me, and she said, yes, can I help you? And I went in the room, and I had tears in my eyes. And you know, and you guys, there was a whole room full of people. And I thought, isn't this weird, all these people? Who the hell are they? And something caught my eye out of the corner of my eye. And I'll be damned if our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, was not sitting on this kid's dresser. Now, if you think I was going to stay out of that room, you're just crazier than hell. I didn't care if I got fired. And I went in there, and I said, whose book is that? And the mother said, that's my book. I'm a member of AA, and so it's my husband, and these are our friends. And come to find out, her sponsor was there, and his sponsor was there, and these people had driven 500 miles to be with this family, and they were not from Los Angeles. And I thought, that figures, that's the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for you. And it was just a real emotional thing. And I went over to the little girl, and I told him I was a member of AA, and she said, oh, isn't that great and stuff? And we talked, and I also told him, I said, don't tell anybody I'm up here because I'll get in trouble. And she said, I understand. We won't say anything, you know. And I went over to the little girl, and the little girl looked at me, and she says, go away. I'm not sick anymore, you know. And I had my surgery stuff on, and I forgot to change clothes, and I guess it scared her. And I said, well, I just came to see how you are. And she said, well, I'm better, you know. And I said, well, I can see you are. And I said, what's that little bear's name? And I thought, Karen, you are so self-centered, I can't even believe it. And she says, well, my bear's name is Karen. And I said, it is. And I said, well, what's wrong with your bear? Why does it have Band-Aids on it? She says, my bear had a liver transplant. And I said, it did. And she says, you can take it home and take care of it, you know. And I the mother said, please take it. She wants you to have it. And I said, oh, I can't do that, you know. And I felt like a fool walking down the hall with that bear, but it is absolutely my prized possession. And I thought, what can I do to give this mother back something, that all the things that I've received from this? And I remembered something that I carry in my pocket, and I carry it in my pocket at work because I want to remember where the hell I'm coming from. There's narcotic keys next to that medallion. And this happened to be for the same amount of years that this mother was sober. And I went over to her and I said, how long have you been sober? And she said, I'm 5 years sober today. And I thought, I'll be damned. I had finally found the person to give my 5-year medallion to. And I give it, you know, they say in Alcoholics Anonymous that we have to give it away to keep it, you know. And I guess it's one way of doing it for me. And I'm selfish with my medallions, and people have to be very special. And I thought, Karen, give it up, you know. And I, because Clancy gave me that medallion, and it's very, very special to me. And I gave it to this woman. I said, I would like you to have my 5-year medallion. And she said, oh, I cannot take that. And I said, oh, please, I want you to have it. And so she took my 5-year medallion, and the nurses got wind of all this, and they got her a cake, and we celebrated her 5 years of sobriety. And, you know, you guys, without you, I would have missed all that. I would have missed all that. I am so grateful for this program. You know, people say to me, you know, that little girl went home, and I understand she's doing very, very well, and there's been no more contact. It's got to be that way for many, many reasons. But anyway, you know, people say to me all the time, Karen, you know, why do you keep doing all this stuff? Why do you keep going to these meetings and sponsoring these people and all this stuff? And I know of no better answer to tell them that one of our 12 traditions says in long form, it says, so this to the end, that my great blessings may never spoil me, that I may forever live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all. And you guys, there's more reasons than that for me, I can assure you. You're the ones that walked with me when nobody else would walk with me, and you held my hand when nobody else would hold my hand, and you told me that you loved me. And goddammit, I believed you. And as a result of that, I'm still alive today. And you know, you taught me how to live, you taught me how to love, you taught me how to keep my pants up, you know. I don't like that much, but you know, you have taught me that. And you really taught me how to eat, how to dress, how to do all those things. And you know, I don't do any of those things very well, but I can tell you that I do one thing with absolute 200% perfection, and that is that I love you more than anything in the whole world. And you know, from an alcoholic hell that I can't even describe, just like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, I have truly been given the keys to the kingdom. And I thank you guys for having me here tonight. I love you more than anything in the world. Thank you for my life.